Now, one of the reasons, as we're going to see, Stalin's acrimony. One of the reasons, as mentioned in Anthony Cave Brown's book, that Stalin was so acrimonious, was the fact that although all the other bridges on the Rhine had been blown up, these highly strategic bridges allowing the Allies, that would have allowed the Allies to cross over into central Germany, the bridge at Remagen, although wired for explosives, when the German demolition experts went to push the plungers and blow the bridge up, they found that for some reason all the wires had been cut. Everybody was told later on that it had been by flying shrapnel. Of course, the odds against all the wires being cut by flying shrapnel, I don't know quite what they'd be. But anyway, this is what indeed led many, including many people in the Allied intelligence services, to feel that some kind of a deal had been cut over the bridge.
And recall that through Pius XII, the very same Pius XII who we saw working with Hitler as early as 1919, and along with his family, had been inextricably linked with the cooperation between Vatican and the fascism, both in Italy and Germany. This same Pius XII is instrumental in opening contacts for a separate peace between the German General Staff and the British and the Americans through OSS's head, William Donovan. So the Vatican role in this, or possible Vatican role, is one of the things to be remembered. Again, this is a speculative element of the broadcast, but nonetheless perhaps a very important one. Continuing now with The Last Hero. In the course of an acrid correspondence among FDR, Stalin, and Churchill, dealing with allegations that the Western powers were secretly negotiating a German surrender that would permit the Wehrmacht to continue operations against the Red Army, Stalin wrote to FDR on April 5, 1945. You affirm that so far no negotiations have been entered into. Apparently you are not fully informed. As regards my military colleagues, they, on the basis of information in their possession, are sure that negotiations did take place, and that they ended in an agreement with the Germans whereby the German commander on the Western Front is to open the front to the Anglo-American troops and let them move east, while the British and Americans have promised in exchange to ease the armistice terms for the Germans. Stalin then made a statement that was not correct, but was fairly close to the truth. Quote, and so what we have at the moment is that the Germans on the Western Front have in fact ceased the war against Britain and America, at the same time that they continue the war against Russia, the ally of Britain and the USA, unquote. He concluded threateningly, I think I must repeat that I and my colleagues would never in any circumstances have taken such a hazardous step, for we realize that a momentary advantage, no matter how great, is overshadowed by the fundamental advantage of preserving and promoting trust between allies. When Roosevelt and Churchill rejected Stalin's accusations, Stalin asserted, it is hard to agree that the absence of German resistance on the Western Front is due solely to the fact that they have been beaten. The Germans have 147 divisions on the Eastern Front. They could safely withdraw from 15 to 20 divisions from the Eastern Front to aid their forces on the Western Front. Yet they have not done so, nor are they doing so. They are fighting desperately against the Russians for Zemlinice, an obscure station in Czechoslovakia, which they need just as much as a dead man needs a poultice, but they surrender without any resistance such important towns in the heart of Germany as Osnabrück, Mannheim, and Kassel. You will admit that this behavior on the part of the Germans is more than strange and unaccountable. Well, again, Stalin's statements here, I think, speak for themselves. What he's questioning is whether or not the seeming disparity between the German military effort on the Eastern Front and on the Western Front in the closing days of the war was really due to the damage done to the Western forces and the incapability of the Germans to transfer a certain portion of their forces from the East to the West. And again, his statements speak for themselves. What you make of it, that's up to each and every listener. But the curious incident of the Remagen Bridge and the negotiations between the Vatican conducted negotiations between the German General Staff, the British, and the Americans is worth evaluating against this background. Cave Brown goes on to say here, whatever the truth of these assertions, Donovan's movements between February 27th and March 27th, 1945, or what is known about them, are troubling. We have seen that there was secret contact between the OSS and Weizsäcker, and there was contact at the same time between Dulles and representatives of the German High Command in Italy, we're going to talk more about that, the object of which was to realize the surrender of the German armies in Italy. Moreover, since the matter of the Remagen Bridge has never been adequately investigated, at least by anyone with any knowledge of clandestine operations, it is at least reasonable for the historian to cast a cold eye on the generally accepted explanation for this remarkable event. Whether Donovan had anything to do with the bridge, we shall never know. His papers say nothing about it. But we do know that a group of Polish engineers was at work in the immediate vicinity of the bridge just before the Americans arrived. Since the Poles sabotaged everything else that was German that came within their reach, it is not unreasonable to suppose that they cut the wires. Nor is it unreasonable to suppose that they were asked to do it by someone in the OSS. There were, after all, Polish representatives at Eisenhower's headquarters and a government in exile in London, and no doubt these individuals had the means to contact the Polish underground in Germany. The mystery attending Donovan's movements between February 27th and March 5th, 1945, certainly suggests his involvement in very secret activities, and at the time there was no OSS activity more secret and important than the various contacts with the German high command, which, as we shall soon see, led to the surrender of all German armies in Italy. Indeed, given WJD's personality, it would have been remarkable had he not been directly involved in such a historic matter. So again, the possibility of the Vatican having basically, and specifically Pius XII, having effected a covert deal between the German high command and the OSS to allow the American armies to pour into Germany ahead of the Russians via the Remagen Bridge is something to think about here. And a pattern of cooperation which has been confirmed, a similar pattern of cooperation to the one speculated about by Cave Brown, has been confirmed in Italy. And these are the aforementioned negotiations between Alan Dulles and the SS forces in Italy, which became known as Operation Sunrise.
And we're going to take that look at Alan Dulles, another American intelligence agent who found favor with the Vatican. And just before we take our next break, what we're going to be reading from here is a section from Covert Action Information Bulletin, otherwise known as CAIB. This is from the number 25 issue from 1985. And this particular article is Nazis, the Vatican, and the CIA is the cover headline. And this subheaded, Dulles and Wolf, the OSS-SS secret deal.
This actually, for the purposes of classification for a covert action, is their Winter 86 issue, number 25.
That's right. Okay, Dulles and Wolf, the OSS-SS secret deal. These long-suppressed details about the post-war U.S. sponsorship of the wanted war criminals Barbie and Schwend, that's Klaus Barbie and Freddy Schwend, both of whom we're going to be talking about later in the special, confirm the recent accusations of John Loftus that the SS Kameraden were exfiltrated as a result of Operation Sunrise, the secret agreement shortly before VE Day between Alan Dulles of OSS Bern and SS General Karl Wolf. As recorded in Dulles's and other establishment accounts, Operation Sunrise concerned the surrender of German troops to Italy to prevent the needless destruction of civilian property and help forestall a takeover of North Italy by the communist partisans in the area. More recently, revisionist historians have focused on the degree to which Dulles and Wolf, the principal negotiators, exceeded their authorization to negotiate and in so doing created a major political rift between Stalin and Churchill. Inasmuch as the armistice in North Italy only preceded that in the rest of Europe by 1 week, Operation Sunrise may have had less impact on the outcome of the war than on the survival of the cadres of the SS. One of the principal SS participants in the negotiations was Milan Gestapo chief Walter Rauf, soon to be a fugitive through the Kameradenwerk. And then they're quoting, according to Loftus, a promise by Dulles of amnesty for SS negotiators led him, that's Alan Dulles, to exploit his connections at the Vatican to smuggle war criminals to South America. Rauf was set up one month after the armistice in Genoa, where, under cover of a Vatican-run refugee relief organization, he reportedly sent some 5,000 Gestapo and SS agents over a four-year period. Among them was Klaus Barbie. On April 27, 1945, after being visited by Dulles' OSS agent Emilio Daddario in Milan, Rauf surrendered to Army CIC. According to recently declassified American intelligence documents seen by Loftus, quote, he told Army CIC that he had made, quote, arrangements for his surrender in order to, quote, avoid further bloodshed in Milan. The arrangements could be confirmed by Huisman, Max Huisman, a Swiss participant in Operation Sunrise, and Mr. Dulles, Allied agents in Switzerland, unquote. Later, Rauf told his interrogators how, quote, he himself had been the go-between in negotiating the secret surrender of the SS armies in Italy. He described how he went to Lugano in March 1945 to arrange the release of Allied prisoners in Rauf's custody as a sign of good faith. In return for the surrender of all SS forces, Dulles promised that none of the negotiators would ever be prosecuted as war criminals. Loftus then confirms the claim of Beata Klarsfeld that Ralph, Beata Klarsfeld is a noted Nazi hunter, confirms the claim of Beata Klarsfeld that Ralph began to work for Dulles and to exfiltrate Nazis through Catholic monasteries while on the OSS payroll. Quote, despite the U.S. Army interrogators' pleas that Ralph, quote, is considered a menace if ever set free and failing actual elimination is recommended for lifelong internment, unquote, Dulles kept his bargain and Ralph was released. According to usually reliable intelligence sources, Dulles then employed Ralph on anti-communist operations in Italy, which was Ralph's specialty under the Nazis. Dulles asked the Vatican to continue his wartime arrangement of using Catholic monasteries and convents to hide OSS agents. After the war, Dulles explained, these safe houses were still needed to smuggle out anti-communist refugees. The Vatican's involvement with Dulles' program was minimal. The church provided food, shelter, and identity cards, as it did to all refugees. It was Dulles' contacts, not the Vatican, who handled the smuggling of Nazis.
We're going to examine that statement in greater depth in a second.
According to top-secret State Department documents, the Italian police provided the false passports for Allied agents. The visas came from the Argentine consulate and the Allied intelligence unit based at Trieste. And the embarkation paperwork was handled by a U.S. State Department officer in Genoa. Genoa, incidentally, was Ralph's area of jurisdiction. All of them worked for Dulles, who set up the unwitting Vatican to be the scapegoat if it was ever discovered that Dulles' anti-communist refugees were really SS intelligence agents. To be sure, there were a few priests and even one bishop who smuggled a few of their own Nazi countrymen through Italy. This must allude to the Croatians, the author has written in parentheses, but that was at extremely low levels of the Vatican and was quietly squelched after the exposure in the Italian press in 1948. The higher-level connection between the Vatican and Dulles is still classified by the government. Okay, well, again, as Dave said, we're going to examine later on in the broadcast the relative merit of the assertion that it was entirely Dulles and that the Vatican was basically an unwitting dupe of Alan Dulles. But the fact remains, at the very least, that what we're talking about here is a major role being played by the OSS and specifically by Alan Dulles out of his position in Bern to smuggle Nazi war criminals, Nazi SS men, out of Europe using the Vatican safe house network. Now, as to what the Vatican's involvement in it is, we're going to look at that later.
What we're really going to be doing is looking at the relative roles in an operation permitting the survival of large elements of the fanatical SS organization of the Nazis, many of whom were war criminals of the highest order, a thing which not only permitted many of them to survive, it permitted many of them to go to work for the Galen organization and the CIA after the war. Recall that at the end of World War II, Reinhard Galen, Hitler's intelligence chief for the Eastern Front, jumped to the CIA with, for all intents and purposes, his entire organization. Later, that organization became the CIA's Department of Russian and Eastern European Affairs, the de facto NATO intelligence organization, and eventually the West German intelligence service, which it is to this day. This organization, the Galen Org, employed large numbers of Nazi war criminals and former SS and Gestapo veterans, and many of the ones who went to work for it around the world came from this Operation Sunrise. And what we're looking at with Operation Sunrise, the negotiation for the surrender of the SS armies in Italy, and also the resulting establishment of this Vatican so-called rat line out of Italy for the Nazis, we're looking at an operation which really was undertaken in various at various stages by three different organizations. One, the SS themselves. Another, the Vatican, which we're going to, we feel, establish in spite of the conservative statement made here by Loftus that the Vatican was innocent. And we're going to take a look at some apparent Vatican complicity in the establishment of this very rat line. And we're also, of course, going to take a look at the U.S. intelligence role at greater length. So what we're going to be looking at during the next portion of our broadcast largely is the establishment of the so-called rat line, the SS exit, what's the word, exit pathway from Europe set up largely in cooperation with the Vatican, but as we're going to indicate, it was a cooperative effort begun really, or at least in part, by the SS and continued then by the Vatican and U.S. intelligence in cooperation.
Again, as Dave mentioned, that's what we're going to be looking at, and that's coming up in the next hour of Radio Free America. In the interim, broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills, and we'll be back after a short break with more of Radio Free America. our special archive broadcast here, and our special, first of our special May broadcasts on the Mediterranean merry-go-round, or the events surrounding the shooting of Pope John Paul II. I'm Nip Tuck. I'm in the studios with Dave Emery. We've been here since 7. We're going to be here until 12. We got lots of stuff to talk about.
And we're also going to have time for phone calls, at least during about the last hour or so of the broadcast. So do keep your wits about you, because if you'd like to feedback on this, ask us any questions, you know, cuss us out, make any comments. So there will be time to do that at the end of the broadcast.
Yes, again, preferably comments and questions and cusses germane to the subject matter at hand tonight, since this is an archive broadcast.
And also one that we've been working towards for, literally looking towards for years. We've been trying to get this Pope material on tape, and here during the month of Mayhem, we're in a position to do it. And by the way, this is largely sort of our way of thanking our listeners for their very generous contributions to purchase two marvelous cassette decks for this broad for the station here, both of which are being used to record the broadcast for DAFCore. So this is, again, by way of a large thank you. Now, we've been reviewing the history of the association between fascism and Vatican. We'll sum some of that up at the conclusion of the prepared portion of the broadcast. Something we neglected to mention, by the way, in the last article that Nip read you, it was from Covert Action Information Bulletins, issue number 25, the winter of 1986. We neglected to mention, however, the article from which that was taken. The article, again, from Covert Action number 25, winter of 86, was entitled How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserved Each Other, and it was authored by Peter Dale Scott, a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, one of the top researchers in this field and a man whose work that we've relied on many, many times in the past. So that's the article that Nip was reading you from. Now, the essence of that article was that that Vatican elements, church elements, were used by Alan Dulles and the SS elements fleeing Italy following Operation Sunrise, a negotiated surrender between SS General Karl Wolf and Alan Dulles of the OSS. This surrendered the German armies in Italy a week before the main German surrender in Europe. And out of this early surrender was born an act of cooperation between the SS and the OSS in Italy, in which Alan Dulles not only provided immunity from prosecution for war crimes, but also safe passage out of Italy. Now, in the section of the Peter Dale Scott article that Nip read you, John Loftus, a former Justice Department investigator, said that basically the Vatican was an unwitting dupe in this process. We're going to basically blow that element of that article out of the water, and at the very least, let's be modest. We're going to call it seriously into question. What we're going to be doing during the next section of our broadcast is examining the so-called rat line. Since the arrest and extradition of Klaus Barbie in early 1983, the rat line has come very much into focus. It basically was the Vatican assisted and to a considerable extent sponsored exit pathway for the Nazis out of Europe to places like Latin America. And what we're going to be looking at in the development of the rat line is, among other things, how this operation, which in turn was funded by a counterfeiting operation we're about to talk about, how this operation represented sort of a joint effort and a continuous political operation going from the Third Reich to the Vatican to Western intelligence, specifically U.S. intelligence. In this regard, it's sort of similar to the continuing guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe we talked about in Radio Free America number 1, in which basically a Third Reich military operation was then continued and sponsored by the fledgling Central Intelligence Agency. The events we're about to discuss are analogous in certain respects. Now, keeping in mind the so-called rat line, the Alan Dulles and OSS assisted, Vatican assisted pathway to get Nazis out of Europe and Italy and over to places like Latin America, we're going to be taking a look at how that operation was funded. And the first section we're going to be looking at comes from a book called Aftermath, subtitled Martin Bormann and the Fourth Reich. It's authored by Ladislaus Farrago, last name F-A-R-A-G-O, published in hardcover by Simon & Schuster, copyrighted 1974. There's also a softcover edition, same copyright date, published by Avon Press. Now, Farrago, by the way, was in charge of operations and planning for the Special Warfare Division of U.S. Naval Intelligence in World War II, later went to work for the CIA. And what he did, basically, was to investigate the post-war Nazi empire in Latin America, and among other things, to track down Martin Bormann. Now, official, I guess you might call it pop history, the same kind of history that maintains that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy, has maintained that Martin Bormann died in the ashes of the Third Reich. That is, unfortunately for us, blatant nonsense. Martin Bormann was alive and well, at least as of 1974, and for a considerable time afterward. not only Ladislaus Farrago, but a couple of other authors, one of whom we're going to be looking at tonight, have been able to trace and chronicle to a considerable extent the very active post-war Nazi career of Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's designated successor and appears to have basically assumed the leadership of the Nazi Party in exile. And although we're not going to be dealing directly with Bormann tonight, except for one small section, it is worth noting for future reference that Martin Bormann survived the Third Reich and basically was very, very active as the head of the Nazi Party in exile after World War II. And again, Farrago's his credentials as an investigator here, in charge of operations and planning for U.S. Naval Intelligence during the Second World War, and the Special Operations Division of Naval Intelligence, and later a key operative for CIA. Now, the operation that he's going to be discussing here is an SS counterfeiting operation called Operation Bernhard. And one of the key people connected with this is a man named Friedrich Schwend, last name S-C-H-W-E-N-D. We're going to talk a little bit right now from Farrago about Operation Bernhard and Friedrich Schwend, and Nip is going to fill in a lot more information, and in turn, we're going to be connecting this up with the aforementioned Alan Dulles and OSS SS rat line out of Italy. From Aftermath, Farrago writes as follows. At 11:30 p.m. on April 12, 1972, in Santa Clara, a suburb of Lima, the capital of Peru, an army of 150 hand-picked policemen laid siege to a fortress-like compound across the street from a busy Texaco filling station. Behind the thick walls that surrounded the enclave lived Lima's most controversial resident, posing as a humble chicken farmer and insisting that he was doing nothing more sinister than raising poultry in his stronghold. He was, in fact, a 66-year-old German named Friedrich Schwend, a man of mystery, although the most dramatic phase of his checkered career had been exposed in several books. A swaggering SS colonel during World War II, Schwend had been the key man in Operation Bernhard, concealing a fantastic Nazi scheme to counterfeit the notes of the Bank of England and flood the world with the fake currency. The idea was to undermine Britain's economic base in its war effort by destroying the pound sterling in the international marketplace. I would add that was one of the aims. Another aim was to obtain working capital for the Nazis by changing in the counterfeit currency for real currencies and gold and jewelry, which obviously the practical utility of that both during and after the war need not be elaborated on. But Friedrich Schwend, key man in a Nazi counterfeiting operation called Operation Bernhard, one of whose aims was to undermine Britain's currency and weaken their war effort. That was only one of the aims, as we're about to see.
Okay, now reading from a book called The Bormann Brotherhood by William Stevenson, S-T-E-V-E-N-S-O-N, not to be confused with William Stevenson, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S-O-N, author of A Man Called Intrepid. The book is copyright 1973 by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich, Incorporated of New York. And again, they're talking about Operation Bernhard, as Dave just mentioned. The Nazi forgeries, and again, we're talking about the forgery of pounds, British pounds. The Nazi forgeries were the work of prisoners under suspended sentences of death. It was thought for a long time that the sole purpose of manufacturing fantastic sums of British money was to wreck the British economy. If the integrity of British money became questionable in neutral and allied countries in the middle of a war, the results would be catastrophic. Only much later was it evident that the counterfeit money had been exchanged for valid currency by Bormann's agents, working through banks in Spain, Switzerland, and Sweden. The fake notes had been used to finance Nazi Germany's intelligence operations, notably the spy in the British embassy in Turkey, known as Cicero, who sold secret files to the Nazis for 300,000 British pounds sterling, all of them forged. But the sums used to help Germany's war effort were nothing to those misdirected to prepare nest eggs abroad for men on the run. Bernhard Krueger was in 1942 the director of a department of the Central Security Office of the SS that had been faking British currency since 1940. It grew out of all recognition when Martin Bormann was confirmed as secretary to the Führer and issued orders that went beyond anything the stiff-necked bankers and civil servants of the Reich Printing Office and the Reichsbank had envisaged. Just outside Berlin, in one of the most closely guarded camps in the country, groups of highly skilled technicians were gathered. The paper for the forged British notes had to be manufactured from pure linen. Watermarks had to be introduced, and the paper then treated to defy expert inspection. Printing and engraving took place in Block 19, an isolated shed from which escape was not just impossible, but unthinkable. Walter Schellenberg has described some of the problems. Quote, The Secret Service forged... Oh, go ahead.
Walter Schellenberg, by the way, or Walter Schellenberg, was head of the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, which is the actually the overseas branch of the SS Intelligence Service. That's who's about to give the description Nip's going to read.
The Secret Service forged banknotes and rubles to finance our work. Then it became a much bigger operation. It took 2 years to imitate the so-called greaseproof paper needed for English pound notes. We had two large paper mills devoted entirely to that work alone. Engraving was complicated by the fact that 160 identifying marks had to be discovered in each note and then copied by the most skilled engravers. Professors of mathematics worked out a complicated formula by which they could anticipate each new issue of Bank of England notes. This was done so that the registration number on each banknote was always just about 100 to 200 figures ahead of the real notes coming off the presses in London. Schellenberg was instructed to purchase good currency with a proportion of the forged notes. He believed Bormann was putting the notes into categories by testing them in foreign banks. The Grade 1 notes were finally converted into American dollars. In theory, the operation came under Himmler, but he frequently had little to say in these things and was often unaware of details of an operation so vast. Bormann, on the other hand, was expert in handling money and had a cast-iron memory. The chief bookkeeper of the operation was a Czech political prisoner, Oskar Skala. He testified after the war that the, quote, plant produced 400,000 notes a month, and that Kruger and Schwend packed away a proportion of the Grade 1 notes in large wooden boxes. Again, the Schwend alluded to was the poultry farmer in Lima, Peru, that we were talking about just a moment ago. Another expert, a concentration camp inmate who was awaiting the gas chamber because he was a gypsy, Sally Smolyanov, specialized in American dollar bills up to denominations of 100. His work had been known to J. Edgar Hoover for some years, it later turned out, because Smolyanov had been a forger by profession who specialized in U.S. currency. It was pure luck that Kruger and Schwend found him in a death camp. Smolyanov told the story to Scotland Yard and American investigators that seemed fantastic, except that the evidence was there in Gallery 16 near the village of Radelzipf, part of the Alpine Fortress. The gallery was in an underground network of storage corridors and workshops. Along the 200-foot tunnel were the banknote presses and machinery, which had been transferred from Berlin. Smolyanov said they had been moved, kit and caboodle, while Himmler was trying to make a deal through Count Bernadotte. He had failed by then to secure his future by selling the lives of Jews to his American contacts. Schellenberg had come to the glum conclusion that the American rabbinate did not wish to discuss terms of such an obscene nature. The factory for the manufacture of fake banknotes was discovered first when American intelligence men tripped over a truckload of counterfeit notes. The notes were in wooden boxes, each box with a manifest stapled inside. The discovery was made soon after Hitler's suicide, and the truck was trundling along a back road of his Bavarian fortress. The German army captain driving the truck simply told his American captors where to look for the printing presses that had almost wrecked Allied fortunes while they were making the fortune of their sponsor, Bormann. A version of events was made public. Kruger, it was said, had disappeared from Gallery 16 at the end of the war after giving orders that all records were to be burned and the printing dyes sunk in Lake Toplitz. The craftsmen had been sent out to Ebensee concentration camp to be exterminated. Out of 9 million Bank of England notes, with a face value of about $600 million, about $6 million worth went to the Mideast to support German activities among pro-Nazi Arab leaders, and about $30 million worth went to neutral countries to pay German accounts. This left a sizable amount still to strike off the books. Where was it? The Bank of England withdrew from circulation its banknotes of most denominations and exchanged them for five-pound notes of a new design in which a fine metallic thread had been drawn through the fabric in a manner thought to be proof against the most clever forgers. No explanation was given for this decision to Parliament. It was a desperate measure to kill the fake currency already in circulation. It succeeded to a limited extent. Foreign banks were caught with large sums of money, which they were able to change for the new currency if they worked fast enough. A number of banks, however, chose to take a loss. These were the banks on which Allied intelligence focused its attention after the war. Nothing is so secret as the world of finance. Nothing so sacrosanct as money. The movements of forged currency and gold are probably at the top of the list of priorities when it comes to preserving secrecy. The real fate of the Nazis' funny money has never been disclosed in documents made public. A rough estimate, based on independent calculations, is that about $300 million worth of forged notes was converted into usable currency to finance post-war Nazi groups in the Mideast and South America, and that $500 million worth of gold was fed into circulation through South Africa, where it can be transshipped to that, quote, eternal sink for gold, India, and through Hong Kong to China. In both instances, neither buyer nor seller is much concerned about origin.
Okay, so basically that is what Operation Bernhard was about, a massive forging operation of primarily British, also American currency, intended not only, perhaps, to wreck the British wartime economy, but primarily to provide working capital for German espionage operations. One of the German espionage operations which this funded was the operation of the Rat Line. Now, the Rat Line involved two of the key names we're going to be looking at. First of all, a man named Bishop Alois Hudal, H-U-D-A-L, a pro-Nazi cleric, who was one of the key people who ran the Rat Line. We're going to see reference to Hudal here. We're going to look at Hudal at greater length here in just a second. Bishop Hudal was one of the key people running the Rat Line. Hudal was the top Vatican administrator in dealing with this particular operation, again, in partnership not only with the OSS, but also the SS itself. This is a sort of a tripartite operation to provide exit for the Nazis from Italy and Europe after the war. And as we're going to look at here, Operation Bernhard, the funds from Friedrich Schwenn's Operation Bernhard served in considerable measure to finance the Rat Line, which involved a large amount of cooperation from the Vatican. Turning back once again to Aftermath by Ladislaus Farrago. Of Operation Bernhard and the Rat Line and the Nazis brought out of Europe by it, Farrago writes, many of the fugitives have money of their own to take care of themselves. Heinrich Müller, for example, he, by the way, was the head of the Gestapo, arrived in Rome with a suitcase full of American dollar bills. It proved enough to sustain him for years in Europe and pay for his trip to South America in 1950. Others, like Raha, also possessed the money they needed to finance their escape. As documents found in Lima in 1972 tend to prove rather conclusively, the bulk of the money the bishop, that's Hudal, needed was the bulk of the money the bishop needed was placed at his disposal by an obscure benefactor in Switzerland. He was, in fact, a financier named Friedrich Freddy Mercer, M-E-R-S-E-R, partner of Friedrich Schwend in Operation Bernhard. The money came from the hoard Schwend had amassed in Swiss accounts from the revenue produced by the exchange of the counterfeit pounds for hard currencies. And I'm going to repeat that last sentence again, because this is the funding for the Rat Line. The money came from the hoard Schwend had amassed in Swiss accounts from the revenue produced by the extension of the counterfeit pounds for hard currencies. Irrespective of what it cost, the rescue work of Bishop Hudal was a vast and enormously complex operation, what with guiding thousands of fugitives through the tight security network that the Allies had thrown over Italy. Hudal's Vatican cover was of enormous help, of course, especially since the Allied authorities in Rome went out of their way to accommodate the Holy See and let nothing disturb their friendly relations with the Pontiff. So again, an operation which is in part a Vatican operation, in part an OSS operation, is financed by an SS counterfeiting operation, and that in turn provides the funding for the exits of many of the key SS people out of Italy and Europe.
Okay, now we're going to look at the actual setting up of parts of the Underground Railroad, the Rat Line, whatever you want to call it, and the participation in it of some key figures, one of whom is going to later on wind up as a pope, not Pius XII, who we've already talked about, but a man named Joseph Montini, who is eventually going to become Pope Paul VI. Prior to that, however, we're going to look at the involvement of a man, a bishop, the Most Reverend Alois Hudal, H-U-D-A-L. And Hudal was a German-speaking bishop located, working largely out of the Vatican, but he was himself a German national. Alois Hudal wound up, during wartime, not only supporting the Nazis, but at the end of wartime and after the war, supporting the Nazis in a much more concrete manner than he ever had during the war when they were doing pretty well for themselves. Anyway, we're going to read again from... And I just lost the title page here.
This is Aftermath.
This is still Aftermath. Okay, good. While Father Liber and other German priests in Rome, among them Monsignor Johannes Schönhofer of Propaganda Fides, Rector Ivo Zeiger of the Collegium Germanicum, and Father Augustine Meyer, a professor at the Benedictine University of San Anselmo, intensified their anti-Nazi activities at the Vatican at great peril to themselves, Bishop Hudal became the spiritual director of a band of pro-Nazi clerics in Rome. He aligned himself with Giovanni Prezioso, a rabidly anti-Semitic former priest who edited La Vita Italiana, a Jew-baiting newspaper patterned on Der Stürmer, and was, quote, in touch with a mystery-shrouded Benedictine monk, Prior Hermann Keller, who showed up in Rome from time to time to spy on the Vatican for the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, the Nazi secret intelligence service, whose paid undercover agent he was throughout the war. So even during wartime, as mentioned, Hudal's sympathies were already on the side of the Nazis, and he was already allying himself with not only anti-Semitic priests, but in fact people like Hermann Keller, who were actually agents of the SD.
Now, again, Bishop Hudal is the fellow who is instrumental in setting up this rat line and administering large elements of it on behalf of the Vatican. He does so in cooperation with the OSS and U.S. intelligence, which covets many of these Nazis as anti-communist agents. The funding comes from an SS counterfeiting operation, as we've looked at. And it's worth noting that not only Bishop Hudal's rise in the Catholic Church itself, but also much of his doctrinaire anti-communism, which led to much of his sympathy for the Nazis, came from his long-standing association with a fellow named Eugenio Pacelli, the same papal nuncio to Munich who was placing money in Hitler's hand, the same archbishop who helped negotiate the Vatican Treaty, who helped set up the accord with Hitler, the same Eugenio Pacelli, very close to Bishop Hudal and instrumental in his rise in Vatican circles. Again, reading from Aftermath by Ladislaus Farrago. Speaking of Hudal, his long friendship with Eugenio Pacelli began in 1924, when the future Pope Pius XII, then the papal nuncio in Germany, recommended Hudal for the rectorate, the office he held for 28 years until his retirement in 1952. Hudal drew from his great friend's unrelenting opposition to atheistic communism, unquote, the inspiration for his own mission. And he was stimulated in his work by Pacelli's predilection for and skill in secret diplomacy. It was in turn the cardinal, when he was back in Rome as Secretary of State, who obtained for Hudal the titular bishopric of Aella and personally officiated at his consecration. So, again, a connection here between Pacelli and Hudal, the main Vatican administrator of the so-called rat line.
Okay, so towards the end of the war, as it became obvious that the Third Reich was crumbling, that the Allies were winning, and that in fact, although they had suffered grievous losses, that the Soviets were going to survive World War II, the pro-Nazi elements in the Vatican went into a bit of a fit and became very upset, and decided that they were going to have to do something about what was the oncoming destruction of the Nazi Party and the Nazi structure. And, of course, they had partners in this, namely in people like Martin Bormann, who, as we talked about through Operation Bernhardt, were already preparing large sums of money to enable themselves to fund their way out of Europe. Okay, reading more from Aftermath by Ladislaus Farrago. Bishop Hudal thus moved with all his prodigious energy and ingenuity to aid the individual Nazis. These are the ones trying to escape. In the process, the supply of false identities became a primary and urgent concern. Various organizations, including the International Red Cross and established refugee agencies, chipped in, providing travel documents to applicants who registered under false names and whose vital statistics were accepted without any proof asked. There was recourse to the nearly 10,000 blank Argentine passports and identity certificates Colonel Peron had put into Nazi hands even before the collapse. Also available by the hundreds were fake credentials and forgeries from the collection of the German Secret Service Combine, the Gestapo, the SD, and the Abwehr. And I should just mention, too, that it's more than a little significant that, as they mentioned, the nearly 10,000 blank Argentine passports used that were given to the rat line by Juan Perón of Argentina, because Argentina is going to wind up to play a very large part in this entire thing by the time our five-part series is done. You will see where Argentina fits into all this, is all I'll say at this point. Most important and most easily accessible to Hudal and his aides was the Holy See as an authentication center. As a rule, the Vatican had two kinds of travel documents. Under the Lateran Treaty of 1929, you will remember, of course, that largely negotiated by Francesco Pacelli, Bishop Udall's friend Eugenio Pacelli's brother.
Also Eugenio, too, working on behalf of the Vatican.
Bureau of Monsignor Montini's section of the Secretariat of State issued regular passports to the approximately 1,000 citizens of the sovereign state of Vatican City, and for that matter, to any priest of whatever nationality who traveled on the business of the Curia Romana. Also under Monsignor Montini, the Refugee Bureau, which was a truly Catholic charitable organization in that it cared for all sorts of, quote, runaways marooned in Rome without regard for their nationality or creed, issued, quote, identity certificates. They were patterned after the so-called Nansen passes, named for Dr. Fridtjof Nansen, the great Norwegian explorer and humanitarian who was instrumental in the establishment of a high commission of refugees by the League of Nations in 1921 and functioned as its director until his death in 1930. Now, in 1945, on Bishop Udall's intervention, with the Pope's explicit permission, Monsignor Montini authorized a radical change in the routine of both offices. A limited number of regular Vatican passports was given to a handful of, quote, important Nazis, who took on clerical guise to become eligible for these most coveted of travel documents. It is a matter of record that 13 of the top Nazis, among them Martin Bormann, reached South America disguised as Catholic priests on regular Vatican passports made out to Spanish-sounding aliases chosen for them. Such a passport was found among the impounded papers of Friedrich Schwend in Lima. He kept it as a souvenir, together with an assortment of other bogus documents he used on his later travels. Okay, so the key points here are that with the direct, explicit permission of Pope Pius II, the same Eugenio Pacelli we've been talking about all along, and on Bishop Udall's intervention, Bishop Udall tied to all these various anti-Semitic, pro-Nazi forces in the Vatican.
Also very close to Pacelli for a long time.
And close to Pacelli. Monsignor Montini, who is Monsignor Joseph Montini, later to become Archbishop and Cardinal, and eventually to become Pope Paul VI, authorized a change that would allow passports to be given to important Nazis like Martin Bormann and Friedrich Schwend, and that they could pass themselves off as priests, thus achieving the highest degree of protection that they could achieve from the Vatican, and then thereby get to South America. And I should just mention, since this is radio, we can't show you that it, in the photograph section of Ladislaus Fraga's book, Aftermath, about Martin Bormann, he has photographs of several of the actual passports, including some of the documentation used by Martin Bormann to get into South America. So when we're talking earlier about the sort of questionable nature of the statement made by John Loftus that the Vatican was an unwitting dupe of Alan Dulles in the aid given to escaping Nazis, Ladislaus Fraga's work, including the actual photographs of the passports used, would tend to disprove that.